From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Wisso by Nugent Parker. Nugent Parker enjoyed a vogue between the wars, and Wisso was voted the best short story of 1928. Parker wrote it while living in Oscar Wilde's old house in Tite Street, Chelsea. Soon after completing it, he claimed he had the pleasure of meeting Whistler's ghost at midnight in the garden. Those who had seen him, those who had endeavored to speak with him face to face, until suddenly they had realized that it would be ridiculous to carry the conversation further. These people searched diligently among the proper sources and called him Wisso. It may be that there was more than the merest ghost of a reason for such a name. Yet he was so secret, so elusive, they could not be sure. His habitation was a great, silent, early Victorian house, and it stood on a semicircle of drive behind two gates that swung rheumatically on their creaky hinges off the leafiest avenue of that old watering town. There are many such houses sunk in sleep on the vetered, lazy borders of Chelsover, their emptiness of all sound save the frequent mutter of raindrops from the eaves, the filmy stare of their windows, their endless, aimless hours. These things give them the air of old, querulous people who have found no benefit in the health-giving waters of Chelsover, but have sat themselves down within sight of that hope-shattering spa to watch others pass by them on the same misguided errand beneath the whispering trees. Especially the two gates were two old, stuffy gentlemen who wheezed and croaked and told doubtful stories whenever anyone took them for a moment by the latches and walked with silent footsteps up the lichen drive to the old house where the old man lived. They say that he wore knee breeches and that whenever he took his walks abroad, a threadbare plum-colored surtout with the tightest of waists and a whole battalion of buttons glowed like a dying smithy amidst the leaf shadows. But Wisso of Two Gates walked so rarely in the daytime and seldom beyond the confines of his house. The night was his, and the very early morning, when the moon shining into an open upper window brightened the gleam in his eye and darkened the lines on his face. Then would certain belated residents of Chelsover, lifting their heads, gaze fearfully at the old man lurking there. Those of them that knew his story, yet they never ceased to wonder when that strange figure met their eyes. They wondered at the truth of many tales concerning him. They wondered at the relentless spirit that would not let him sleep. There were occasions when he was not to be seen at his accustomed vigil, times when these same residents peered anxiously over the lower windows to catch the fleeting glimpses of his ghostly figure as it wandered from room to room. It was so white, so frail, it shone so queerly in the dark passages and the half-light of the hall. Sometimes, when he caught sight of himself in the dusky, all but invisible, depths and boundaries of a mirror, Wisso, too, would start and shudder at the spectral shape that had confronted him there. His face was as white and crumpled as a ball of paper, His shrunken legs appeared as though they might drop at any moment from the loosely buckled ends of his knee breeches. His knuckles were as big as buttons, as big as the buttons on his plum-colored shirt out. But the contemplation of this disturbing figure seldom held him for long. Soon he would be through with the ghost-gazing, would be off again upon his nocturnal rambles, drifting and gliding, watching at the window, caring for no man, a shadow of fled glories passing through the house. And as silently as Wesso, the years passed too. Time was long in bringing change to the somber mansion, and the dreaded invasion, when it did come, came neither very suddenly nor very gradually. It seemed to slip into his life like a visitor who had hailed him before opening the door. It seemed, perhaps even more vividly, to have slipped out from a world that had nothing whatever to do with his own, a world with a dry mouth and a grisly tongue in its cheek that caused him rather frantically to think of ghosts. Ghosts in the old house? Ghosts within the gates? Impossible, thought the old man relentlessly, yet in the same moment realized that the signs had come and he had not heeded them. For a week, a month, the visitor had hailed, and Wesso had not attempted to open the door. Surely they were incontestable, those once unmeaning events that suddenly he remembered one very early April morning in the shuttered drawing room, where his eyes were opened by a sign which in its own turn was a prelude to a greater sign in store. An odor had reached him, a sweet, ineffable odor that seemed to wrap his frail body in kindly, pleading voices of the past. He fancied that a window must be open and a shutter unlatched. But he knew that no flowers grew now in the unwalked wilderness of a garden, nor was there any scent in the sycamore tree, whose topmost branches fell barely short of his bedroom window sill. The incident had disturbed him, without giving cause for any particular fear in his awakening mind, but some time later, when he had left the drawing room and was moving noiselessly across the black spaces of the hall, a sound had started at his elbow, a tiny catch of the breath, as though, ah yes, a ghost had sighed, and he had fled in a high frenzy up the staircase to fashion the moonbeams of his bedroom into the forms and murmurs of ghosts. The moon left his window and went her way, but still he sat on, round-eyed, probing shadows of the immediate past. A week, a month ago, the signs had come, and he had not heeded them. A vague hint of preparation, he could not define it exactly. In rooms and halls and passages, a brighter, cleaner atmosphere, even at midnight, that seemed to envelop him at every turn of the stair. These were the little things, scarcely felt in the hour of their happening, that jumped to his memory now, and kept him vigilant for many weeks to come. Sleeping by day and walking by night, his long-established mode of living was highly favorable to a proper study of ghosts. He would sit in the great lofty bedroom whose window looked over the sycamore tree. He would sit there very silently, with the door a little open, hoping for the arrival of those invading spirits whose voices he dreaded to hear. It was a faded, murky room, that in which the crowning evidence of a supernatural world had come to him at last. The bed stood out like a draped coffin on a bier. Heavy curtains hid the two tall windows that might have been the black mouths of tombs. One of these windows had been open, and the curtains parted on the night when he heard the spectral cry. The sound had awakened him, and for many moments afterwards he fancied that he could hear the whistle of the wind. But the cord of the window blind hung motionless in the still night air. Nothing stirred in that vast tomb behind two parted curtains, and suddenly he knew that the sound was coming from within the house, that in some distant room a ghostly company was dancing to a quiver of spectral music and a riot of fitful elfin laughter. Trembling in every limb, old Wesso flung off the bedclothes and hurried to the door, but the lock was rusty and the key refused to turn in his nerveless fingers. He went to the window, peeped down into the garden and up into the sky. He was scared, he was shaking, he wanted to hide the tempestuous music that danced in his ears. A sickle moon was rising above the avenue that led into Chelsover. Already through the mesh of distant leaves, she had begun to sprinkle her dust onto the sleepy head of the sycamore tree, and now a cool wind blew into the old man's face, and the far distant shunting of a train told him that his usual hour for rising was near. But this time he did not rise. Instead, he lay again beneath the bedclothes, with fingers pressed into his ears and the sheets pulled over his thin gray hair, and at intervals throughout the night, in his waking moments and in his troubled dreams, he heard the company of ghosts and the flying music and the distant room and the whole house dancing and dancing. So the ghosts came, and Wesso knew now that the manifestations were something more real than the vague voices of the house and garden. He did not hear them on the following night. A week went by, and the heart of the house was wrapped in silence. His first thought was to locate the room of the riotous dancing. He fancied it must be the drawing room, but when at last he ventured within it, no sign of the dancing was there. His heart thumped as he glided, silent as a shadow, across the moonlit floor. But again the odor assailed him, subtle and frightening, speaking to him in a voice of the past. Old Wesso caught his breath. So they were here always now, and every crack and corner watching him, never to go. He was able no longer to think of the house as his own. When they came again, he was ready for them. He was sitting in his room, the door open, ready and waiting, dressed in the plum-colored sort-out and loose knee breeches of a bygone year, and he began her display by creaking the stairs and uttering little outbursts of laughter, until presently all individual sounds were swallowed in the dance. The music swirled, the voices rose and fell, the house rocked as before, and Wesso stood in his doorway, round-eyed, and with his mouth pursed as if for whistling, trying to summon up courage to obey the most articulate voices that he fancied he could hear at odd moments calling to him to join them. Thenceforth, the wild elfin music of the ghost became an established custom in that house. Wesso would wait it in fear, but the fear was changed into a momentary wonder when the first gay notes arrived. He did not hear it every night. Often a whole week would go by, and the long early hours of the morning brought no sign. He would sit in the great lofted bedroom whose windows looked over the sycamore tree, and he would sit there very silently, with the door a little open, hoping for the return of those invading spirits whose voices he dreaded to hear. And when they came, and the wrinkled cheeks of the house were smoothed out with a great burst of music, always the first fear would creep back into Wesso, and it was many weeks before he ventured beyond the doorway while the ghosts danced. But as time brought less restraint to the ghostly visitors, so also it brought a sense of boldness to Wesso. The anxiety of waiting for their return was lessened by these shortening intervals of silence. His first horror began to depart, and he found himself looking forward with increasing pleasure to those nights when music tossed above the whistle of the wind, and the wind tossed over the trees, calling his name. Wesso! Wesso! At first he was scared, sitting there, unable to tell the fancied voice from the real. Then from the wild elements of nature he began to separate the wild elements of the house. The one became a stepping stone to the other, and when at last he realized that a spirit world was taking possession of the old building, superimposing itself upon everything within it, creeping into every crack and cranny, usurping the house's soul, Wesso was not afraid. He felt soothed and strangely gratified at so much ghostly attention. He became quietly interested and began to think. What are these phantoms like, he thought, and strove to picture them. He wondered whether they walked in the daytime, and whether they could be seen outside the realms of darkness. From his scanty knowledge of the ways of ghosts, he decided these two questions in the negative. And sometimes, in his cunning way, he tried to catch the tunes that were filling his nights with pleasure, that bid him leave their singers unmolested because they were as lovely as the shy songs of birds. And although there were moments when his curiosity urged him to put the phantoms to the proof in the broad light of day, yet always he remained loyal to the song's bidding. But as the weeks passed, there came a more daring note to his nightly vigils. There was a cracked spare piano, which in old days had been relegated to some dim room on the drawing-room floor, and one early morning, when the singing and the dancing were over and the house was quiet, Wesso stole down and seated himself in front of the instrument, and there, in the darkness, with notes that came softly at first and finally filled the whole house with song, he, as though to pay back the ghosts in their own ghostly coin, played many bars of his favorite Lucia. When August came and the thick trees of Chelsover lay like a dust sheet over the town, the spirits kept away, and the old house slept dreamlessly with its head upon its arms. Wesso was puzzled. He who once had known and welcomed solitude fretted when he found it again. The round mouth of the night drew him near and pressed its soundless, thick lips to his ear. The empty corner stared at him with tightly lidded eyes. But such a state did not exist for long. The ghostly period had been of too short a duration to have become a necessity for his soul. On the approach of September, his feelings suffered a certain change. Whenever the wind sang, he did not hesitate any longer to attribute the singing to the wind, and it sang to him in warning tones that told him that the ghost's music had been rather monstrously evil. He was not ignorant of such a popular opinion in regard to ghostly phenomena, and his gray head nodded sagely as he wandered from room to room. That strange air of preparation, that freshness in the rooms and passages, a sense of wings flying down the well of the staircase and beating the whole cubical atmosphere of the hall, these facts that had disturbed his solitude as far back as the previous December spoke to him now of the evil nature of ghosts. To minds far less fanciful than his, the creatures might have seemed the more terrible because they had arisen from renovation and progress, and not from decay. He visualized a kind of perverted fungus growing more readily in sweet and dry places of the earth, and when he saw it like this, he shivered in the stirred-out and rattled at the knees. He wanted very earnestly to stamp out the evil. Therefore, one morning, when the moon was still shining and the whole world of Chelsover lay asleep, Wesso crept down to the vast, shutterless library and began to write. He wrote long and laboriously and without a pause. He wrote until the room grew cold and a breeze sighed and shadows stretched sleepily in the garden just before dawn. It was late, very late in the day for Wesso. With his crumpled face, losing all its lines in the soft half-light, his shrunken body merging into the dark pit of the chair, and the old man put away the pen. But on the next evening he rose before midnight and finished his letter, and his buckled shoes went noiselessly up the lichen drive. The gate coughed and wheezed on its rusty hinges. The arched avenue beyond rained countless spears of moonlight and shadow. Screwing up his eyes, he saw that this road into Chelsover was not deserted. A figure stood by the far distant pillar box, a postman, collecting letters in the light of a lamp. Wesso hallooed at him and began to run. "Hiya, ya!" But his rather thin high voice trailed off dismally into the silence. "Hiya!" he called. Perhaps it was difficult for people to see a spare figure amid the spears of moonlight and shadow. "Ahoy!" shouted Wesso again, but the postman did not hear. The fellow shouldered his bag and bustled away, and the plum-colored shirt out and faded knee breeches moved slowly in the direction of the pillar box. There was no need to hurry now. There was no need at all. But there had been no need to hurry at any time during the whole hard business of the letter writing. Although he waited many days, Wesso received no answer. Nobody answered the letter that he had written to the Society for Physical Research at immense pains on two sheets of music, craving help. Near the end of September, the gale set in and the dark cavernous avenue rocked its high head and buried its feet in a spatter of autumn leaves. And the passing residents of Chelsover stopped in their walk with a renewed wonder lifted their eyes towards an open upper window into which the moon was shining, and muttered in their hearts, "There's that Wesso again. There's that strange Wesso as white as a sheet, crouching at the window while the winds cry, 'Wesso!' The spirit is gone from the old man now. A terrible weariness is within him, left by long weeks of waiting for a letter that has not come, and anger, too deep to raise a murmur in the shrunken body, is there. And hope is near dying. It will be quite dead soon, a dead thing drifting in the wake of the past when a few more nights have run, and Wesso has spent his final hours of sitting in the library until the day has broken, peering over long shelves, poring over old books in the still moonshine, hunting for some record of a riddle that he is unable to solve. And always the weariness and the anger are nourished by a return of that tremendous solitude whose embracing arm seems stronger now because he can hear the ghost music again. Soaring, whirling, thumping, flying, the phantom tunes are crowding his night with a fresh fury while Wesso sits in his room, ignored. Hell is summoning its powers to drive him away, yet all its energies are concentrated on the house. The entity of the whole place is being usurped. Its blood is being sapped. The spirits of evil are taking possession. There will be no house of his in Chelsover soon. The leaves of the sycamore shiver against the moon, but the shadow in the old man's mind is deeper than the shadows of the leaves that twist and twirl and mold. Myra jests the whole night long upon his staring face. Near the dawn of a day in late October, Wesso found the book for which he had been searching. It was big and heavy, and time had steeped it in musty odor, and on its front and side in golden lettering, these words were seen: "The Chelsover Chronicles." He opened it thoughtfully, peered into its pages, then, with an impish action, weighed it in his hand. A bulky book, a book that required much time for reading. Ho, ho, utterly foolish to read it here, where at any moment the ghostly crowd might break in upon his studies. So he glided noiselessly up the staircase with the great book tucked beneath his arm. As soon as he had entered his bedroom, he pulled up a chair and began to read. But the windows were closed and the thick curtains were drawn, and the wind soothed him with its subdued thunders, so that after a time he could not keep from nodding, and because he had not found the information that he wanted, he crept into bed and there fell asleep. He awoke some hours later, tired and uneasy. All through his slumbers, he had been haunted by the persistent knowledge that he must continue to read. He listened and thought that he could hear shrill voices out on the old road to Chelsover, boys whistling voices, and sometimes the clatter of cartwheels beyond the heavy curtains. It occurred to him mildly that daylight was come, but the great book lay on a table at his bedside. He stretched out an arm and took up the heavy volume, resting it against his propped knee. An hour passed, and Wesso discovered the secret of two gates. The print was small, on a leaf stained yellow with age. Nevertheless, he was able to read it easily with his tiny staring eyes. Let us conclude this chapter in the Chronicles of Chelsover, in the history of the environments and of the approaches, with the name of one Sylvester Wesso, Colonel of Artillery, who on his retirement from the thunders of the battlefield, spent the remainder of his years in the seclusion of his ancestral home. Doubtless, the event would have been of little interest to my readers. He looked up suddenly, straining his ears. Voices were coming up the stairs. Their voices, talking and laughing. Sylvester Wesso went on. He read on. Had not the aged colonel died rather suddenly, though not very violently, by means of his own hand, a gentle dose of chloroform taken in the silence of the night? They were coming now, the ghosts, they were nearing the door. He took the book under the bedclothes, pulled the sheets over his head, and still he read on. Taken in the silence of the night. The door opened and a girl's voice leapt into the room. "Oh dear," cried, "how dark it is, as dark as pitch." Footsteps hurried across the room. Then the curtains swished back, the blinds tore up, and the vast old room was flooded with the afternoon light. Her eyes glistened as she turned to the young man at her side. "How brave of you to want to sleep here." "Yes, this is our haunted room, the room where our poor ghost lives. I've never seen him, but so I am told." She filled the place with laughter. "The bed's too terribly comfy, they say." She shuddered a little comically as she approached it. "Behold our famous bed." She flung back the bedclothes, piling them up. On the cold sheet, the heavy book, thickly coated with dust that was disturbed but lightly where the sheets had brushed it. And when she saw it lying there, her laugh went, and her heart stopped, and she stood as white as a ghost.